the three presentations, and it only makes sense because the topic is the same, actually, with the variation of countries. But of course, for each for each case that we will be presenting, the those that have worked on it have a slightly different take, as you will see. I will take this opportunity to talk a little bit also about a topic that this workshop and the seminar is about. I will not talk a lot about the transmission paths and so on and so forth, but I want to make some linkages, actually, of topics that we have been touching upon from almost the first day. We have talked about unpaid work. We have talked about different types of methodologies and how they can become gender-informed. And therefore, I will be making some references along those lines. Excuse me, some people have been saying you shouldn't be smoking, and they have a point, so you all now have to deal with my coughing. All right. So the first point I want to make is one that has been made by many in this room already. In the context of the crisis, we must remember that for many people and in many countries, this crisis that we are facing now, starting out as a financial crisis, becoming a global economic crisis, this crisis sits on top of many pre-existing crises. And how people have been affected depends on the country they lived in, the type of work they were doing, the kinds of constraints their own countries have in responding to the current crisis. So it is a good reminder for all of us to think that the consequences of this crisis will come to sit on top of pre-existing levels of poverty. When it comes to work, some people suffered in advance both from lack of jobs and from lack of quality in the work that they do, social protection that they did not have, and many women in particular located at the crossroads between production and reproduction carry a double burden, some of them more of one, less of the other, but nonetheless there are domains of employment and unpaid work that people occupy that we have to be aware of. Income inequality, both between and within countries, one of the things the ILO reports make very clear in the last 2 years is that fundamentally and profoundly, from a macroeconomic point of view, there has been a shift gradually towards profits and away from wages. So the functional distribution of income has been definitely shifting towards profits. And diminishing space for livelihoods, and by that I don't mean just the fact that women do not have land rights, although this is a very important and critical issue. It has to do with land grab. It has to do with water rights. It has to do with Coca-Cola and the whole campaign that was taking place in India against Coca-Cola and all the consequences of a different type of primitive accumulation, essentially, that has been taking place worldwide as part and parcel of globalization. Thinking of the gender dimensions of the crisis, as always, we look at this at three different levels. And the first level we, as GEM people or as macroeconomists, we start out with is macroeconomic concerns. The second layer has to do with institutions and institutional arrangements. The third, and only then can we go to the third, has to do with micro-level impacts, and that depends on the location men and women occupy in the various realms of the world of work and in the world of politics and in the world of culture, etc., etc. But really the determination for most of us goes from macro to the type of institutions that prevail to the micro-level. So at times of crisis, whether there is a fiscal space to react for various countries and employ counter-cyclical policies, is a concern. What kind of policy space countries have, fiscal, monetary, exchange rate policies that they can work on. If I take European countries, I don't want to always go to developing countries and all poor people in poor developing countries. I mean, European countries do not exactly have all that much space either. My own country, Greece, cannot exercise monetary policy, cannot exercise fiscal policy. You are really tied to in terms of the reactions that you can have. Then we have the very big issue of government retrenchment in general that happens in every crisis and the implications of all this on unpaid work. The key issue that comes next, from my perspective, is one of food security or sovereignty, as I have learned now to talk about, and agricultural policies and how those can be adjusted or will not be adjusted and what kinds of adjustment it needs in order to shield people off of the worst of the crisis. And I save this one last, not because it is the least important. In my opinion, it is perhaps one of the most important elements, how we think about employment and work opportunities. These are not just issues that apply to the general public. These are issues that are extremely important for women, women's empowerment, and for gender equality, because it is within these domains that we understand and we situate and experience our lives every day. Once we have all of this in place, then we can talk about intra-household distribution of all sorts of issues, in my opinion, and it can be contested. And we will have lots of time to, I hope, have this conversation today. Okay, so what are the major gender paths of transmission of this crisis? When it comes to paid work, I think we have to pay a lot of attention to export sectors, particularly textiles, consignment, where you have value added in the commodity production chains and where we are located, agriculture and tourism, and why do we have to pay particular attention to gender issues in these domains? It is because we know that women occupy low-paid jobs. We know that in many instances, industries have moved to countries precisely to take advantage of these low costs, and by now there is an international division of labor that indeed, following Sergi's presentations, there is a particular vulnerability for some women. That is not to say that all women are going to be affected, including women in the informal sector. The example I brought up earlier says, actually, that some women will stand to benefit from it. So from crisis, you, including food crisis and prices of agricultural goods going up and down, you have losers and winners. But if we want to have a gendered analysis, these are the issues that we have to be aware of so we can understand clearly how men and women get affected differently. That's all I'm saying here. I'm not saying that women are at the end of it constantly and we have to pay more attention. It depends. The second issue, of course, is on informal work and vulnerable workers. I'm not going to say anything on this because Sergi has done a fantastic job situating all of that for us. The third area is on microcredit and microfinance institutions. We haven't talked at all about that. And it is not by chance, it is not by coincidence. Many of us do not believe that the world's poverty will be solved as an issue, as a problem, if every single woman becomes an entrepreneur. If I look at developed countries and the proportion of people that are entrepreneurs and have small size enterprises and those that have regular employment, we will see that there is no ambiguity about it. So to turn around now and to say people in the third world, people in developing countries, those people better find something to do for themselves, that is not a solution, essentially. Nonetheless, in times of crisis, for the 100 plus million women that are involved in one way or another in micro enterprises and in self-employment and rely on microcredit, there are cases where we can clearly identify the shrinking of space for borrowing, and we have to be aware of it. Again, all I'm flagging here are dimensions and issues that we have to be concerned with. Food security and women in agriculture, that was the entire day yesterday, so again, I don't need to belabor the point. And finally, there is the issue of migration and remittances. We have talked a little bit about it every now and then, but I think it is really a critical one. Perhaps I have used the example, and I want to use it once again. There are countries, including the Philippines, that depend disproportionately, actually, in earning their foreign exchange from remittances. And the example I like to use is what would be the treatment that a company that brings in one-third of the reserves the country is holding, and therefore you don't have to borrow it in the international market, what would be the treatment of such a company at the time that the company goes into some kind of crisis? All kinds of credits would be extended, all kinds of packages, excuse me, like the ones we have seen now with the automobile industry, and many of you were telling the stories in your countries which big industries are being supported. Why? Because it is important for employment. Why? Because it is important for future taxation. Why? For whatever the reasons. But you have a very basic principal agent problem here. You have many, many people, but you don't have representation. So this is something for us to think about for now and for the next crisis, and what kind of banking facilities, institutional arrangements we need to put in place, because indeed migrants and remittances are a big part of the existence, livelihood and support in many, many countries, both at the macro level and for individual families. So these are the issues that I wanted to bring up in terms of a gendered kind of analysis of the crisis. I'm sure that there are many more dimensions. The importance of this crisis in terms of opportunities and in terms of disasters that may be awaiting for us is a very tricky one, because I think that if we do not enter the space right now to ask for very specific, come up with the proposals that John was talking about yesterday and the day before yesterday, so what are the recommendations, exactly what are we asking for? I think the spaces may close in on us fairly quickly. And in the current crisis, I think that there is no economist, actually, including who? Alan Greenspan. I mean, everybody has been saying it, that we miscalculated, that there is something the markets cannot deliver. Okay, so the markets cannot deliver in various domains, and I have just enumerated three key areas here. One that has to do with food prices, and we know the fluctuations in food prices right at, in the middle of the crisis and before the onset of the crisis. Then we know that the financial crisis says something is going on with financial markets. It needs regulation, it needs something, but the markets by themselves will not do it. And then we have this other very big challenge that is constantly there when it comes to markets, which is work and jobs that are not created in sufficient quantities, work opportunities, in order to provide a livelihood for the world's population. So when I look at these challenges that we are faced with and the shaking up, essentially, of the free markets will do it, the free markets will do it, okay, the free markets will not do it, then come the kinds of responses that we may want to introduce into the policy domain. So what is to be done? A lot is being talked about regulation in various markets. When it comes to food security, well, all kinds of ideas are floating out there. When it comes to unemployment, when it comes to jobs disappearing, what is to be done? As our friend and mother of all of us, Niloufer, would say, she's working very hard putting together the conference for the UN at the moment, that's why she's not with us. But the point is, what is to be done? Well, one solution that is not a new idea, it is an old idea that dropped out completely from policy discussions, is the idea of the state assuming the responsibility to provide jobs when the markets and when other production systems within a country fail to provide sufficient employment and sufficient jobs for people. So when that happens, it becomes the responsibility of the state to do it. Well, employment of last resort, that sounds very much like lender of last resort. And once upon a time, there was no lender of last resort. And how did we end up having central banks throughout the world guaranteeing whatever they guarantee in different institutional environments? They guarantee different things, actually. But how did we come to that? There was a shake-up, and there was a new institution that was created, an institutional arrangement. It was not there forever. Take countries that have pension, old age pension systems. Were these always there? No, it's an institutional arrangement. So the fact that it has not existed in the past does not mean that it will not exist, that you cannot have mobilization, that you cannot have enlightened politicians that will introduce it and will work with civil society. I don't know how it will happen in each country, but just because it is not part of what we do, business as usual now, it does not mean that we cannot fight for it. So I want to talk about employment of last resort. A variation, actually, of that. I will talk about a variation of that. I think my colleagues will end up talking a lot more about that, Pavlina Cherneva and Randy Ray, who is joining us today. But what I will talk about is a small program, a variation of the idea that the government can indeed become the employer of last resort. Before I do that, because as I said, my presentation will touch upon a million things, before I do that, I want to just go through some slides that will tell us a little bit about the problem of employment. Forget about the crisis for a minute. And just look at the trends from 1995 to 2005, more or less. And you look across regions, and what you will see is that the employment to output ratio has simply been declining. What does it mean? It means that you need less people to produce a unit of output. So what happens to those people that are not needed now? Unless the rate of growth and the population growth rate are moving in such directions that everybody gets reabsorbed, which is not happening. I don't want to go into the theoretical thing, you know, maybe it could, maybe it couldn't. If this coefficient is greater than that one, it's not happening in the last 10 years. It's not happening in the last 15 years. So we do not have the expectation, I hope, that as technologically we are developing, there will be more and more and more jobs that will be absorbing everybody and everybody. I mean, that is not happening. So first of all, the general trend is one that cannot put our hopes and our faith with markets generating enough jobs, for sure. Then what happens during a crisis? What happens during a crisis is you have different countries that have different exposures. I know you cannot see very well from here, have different exposures to being vulnerable countries. Why? Because to begin with, and given existing trends, you have some countries that had already decelerating growth, already high poverty rates, and therefore, when you put the two of them together and you look at what happens, the location of countries, at the time of crisis, not all countries have the same position. Some countries are more vulnerable than other countries. That's all. Well, what does this next one slide have to do with what we are discussing right now? There is a lot of commotion back there for a very, very good reason. Jayati Ghosh has just joined us. We are thrilled that she's with us. And I'm not going to stop and go and hug her and all of that, but I just had to explain why the commotion more than justified. Okay, so what is this one? This graph here, this bar graph here, and what does it have to do with what we will be discussing? It is not only that different countries face distinct degrees of vulnerability in terms of high growth, etc., it is also the position the country occupied in terms of internal balances, fiscal position, in terms of external debt position, and in terms of the foreign exchange reserves that they have at the time that the crisis hits, because the usual argument is we don't have enough policy space, we don't have enough fiscal space, we cannot really enact the policies and the stimuli policies that we need in order to get out of the crisis. But what I want to show you here is simply that if I take stock of, these are 90 countries, well, maybe I don't have the whole gamut here, the whole list, but the point is that from 2003 to 2007, most countries have been abiding by the IFI's rules and they have been improving their position. So when Smriti tomorrow, I think, or day after tomorrow, will talk to us about the shrinking of spaces that the IMF is talking about, because the IMF is right now lending through facilities that they should not be using. These are external shocks. So why are they imposing conditionalities? This is part and parcel of the macro picture within which we situate ourselves, because this is what countries were doing. Some countries are in very vulnerable positions. Employment was a problem to begin with. The crisis hits. Okay, so this is the backdrop. This is where we find ourselves today. Switch gears completely now to another component, another ingredient that we need to introduce in order to discuss an employment guarantee kind of program for South Africa. And the component that I want to bring in is something that I talked about at the very beginning, which is one of the paths of transmission of the crisis, which goes through unpaid work. So before I go to the impact of the crisis on unpaid work, I want to take a quick look through a few bar graphs of what is the story with unpaid work. Indira and Valeria spent a whole day with us explaining what unpaid work is, the various activities that exist within the domain of unpaid work, etc. But a quick look on men and women and the time that they allocate on unpaid work. There isn't much I need to explain here. It is very, very clear. We all know this bit of information, that it is women that spend more time, most of the time, on unpaid work. And this is just a summary of that. Can everybody see where I'm standing? Yeah? Okay. But now I want to show another graph. And this graph shows the total workload. By total workload, I mean the paid work and unpaid work combined for men and for women. And I want to compare that paid and unpaid work with the earnings gap between men and women. Because the picture that emerges, with the exception of two, three countries, is the following. First of all, in terms of earnings and wage differentials, we know there is no country in the world, actually, that has a reverse trend. Men make more than women, period. A variety of reasons behind it, but that's what it is. And when it comes to the amount of time that they spend, combined workload of paid and unpaid work, in these developed countries, Netherlands, France, etc., you will see that in the Netherlands, men actually, when you combine paid and unpaid work, spend a little bit more time. And so that is also the case for Denmark and for Germany. When it comes to developing countries, you cannot find a similar thing anywhere. So the overall pattern is, if I may say so, women work longer hours, women receive less earnings, combining paid and unpaid work. Okay. So now I'm switching to South Africa. The study I'm going to talk about is for South Africa. But when we look at data, we have said many times, we need not only disaggregation by gender, which we have here, but we need disaggregation according to socioeconomic characteristics that will bring to the forefront whatever we are interested in. So looking at unemployment rates, because remember, what we are going to talk about is a program that provides employment guarantee program in India. In South Africa, it is called Expanded Public Works Program. And in order to introduce the need for the program, I would like for you to look at this picture, when you break down the population by various socioeconomic characteristics, for example, the first line reads ex-homeland, poor. So this is people that are at the line of poverty and below and live in the ex-homeland areas, versus rural, poor, that are involved in commercial activities, versus urban centers, where people live in formal housing but are ultra-poor, you will see that unemployment rates vary a lot. Looking at South Africa as a whole, South Africa has one of the highest unemployment rates, 25 to 40%, depending on how you calculate it. That is amazing. 25%, that was the unemployment rate during the Great Depression in the United States, and that was the Great Depression. There are people that have lived in households where nobody has held a job in formal markets or informal. The informal sector is very small in South Africa, actually, for over 15 years. So the problem of unemployment is severe and it is structural for the case of South Africa. That was the picture for unemployment. Time spent on unpaid work for South Africa, men and women. Nothing I need to explain here. If you need now to break it down by the activities that Indira was talking about, like fuel and water collection, social care, home maintenance, the picture consistently emerges that people that are unemployed or economically inactive, they don't hold jobs essentially, either by they are not recorded, economically inactive, meaning they are not looking for work, they live in households that nobody has looked for work for 15 years, definitely the time that they spend is much higher, and for theoretical reasons we can explain why easily, maybe it will come up in the discussion, but this is the pattern here. People that are employed, men and women, spend less time on unpaid work. How about by poverty status? The ultra-poor spend more time on unpaid work. Women, of course, spend a lot more time. The poor, less, and the non-poor, even less. And now we can have a system through which you can take the time use data information. This is original work, actually, that we have done at the Levy Institute by taking the time use surveys and just rearranging it according to characteristics that we were interested in. And what emerges is that not everybody spends the same amount of unpaid work. There are huge differences by socioeconomic groups. So now we get to why do we need an employment guarantee program? Why do we need an employment of last resort program? And there are a variety of reasons. I want you to read along with me. The first and foremost reason that people have been citing is that work gives dignity, that there is something about being included. Are you going to be exploited? Yes, but so am I, frankly. Am I going to shed any tears about me and you being exploited? Not really. Am I going to shed any tears for people that are exploited and cannot make it and suffer from malnutrition and lack of health, etc.? Of course. But that is not the point. The point here is really that being included, even under terrible work conditions, allows you to mobilize, to organize, to do something about it. Being excluded from participating in forms of resistance that everybody else may or may not enter, depending on political situations, that is really missing out on life, life experience. It is not just about the fact that you don't have the income. Maybe you will get the income with some cash transfer, but it is not quite the same thing. Well, these programs create actually jobs, they create income, but also, and Indira will talk a lot more about it, these programs have the ability to create public and private assets. You're building something through this work. It is not just you make work for people just to hire them temporarily. The whole idea is that you create the types of works that contribute something to society and to communities, infrastructure, etc. But my favorite one is the last one. That's why I have highlighted it, because to me it is a matter of resource mobilization. You know, we talk about resource mobilization, and usually it is the tax base and how can we get more somehow by expanding the tax base and the fiscal space and what have you. Okay, there is a resource. That resource is called labor, and it is staying idle, and you're not putting in place special programs in order to be able to mobilize it. I mean, this is a resource that every country has. So the labor is there. The labor of human beings can be mobilized instead of staying idle. But then how you use it is extremely important. It can be used to promote work that has as its center focus, community development, improving the livelihood of people, but it can also be used in ways that reduces unpaid work. And that is, I guess, where we enter. I'm going to skip this. There have been many direct job creation government programs. Not all of them are employment of last resort. Actually, none of them are employment of last resort. Employment of last resort is something much bigger and different. But not all employment guarantee programs and not all public works programs have been introduced, in my humble opinion, for good reasons. During the period of structural adjustment, you had all over Latin America social funds that were set up. And on the one hand, your macroeconomic framework is saying, cut down expenditures, inflation targeting, reduce, actually bring into the country recession so that you can balance your external position. And at the same time, you say, okay, here is a little pittance that you can use to have temporary programs so that you can create a little bit of employment. Well, this is not what we have in mind when we talk about employment guarantee programs. So let us not confuse, so to speak, the popularistic kind of use, you know, of an idea that has the ability to mobilize and transform society with bad uses of it because it was convenient politically at the moment. You have had many emergency programs. I want to say something about the ILO, actually, because the ILO employment-intensive infrastructure programs have been going on for a very long time. And at the end, I will tell you where you can find information. The basic idea that they had some time ago, 25, 30 years ago, I guess, was that when countries spend their hard currency to import machinery and materials in order to build roads, bridges, and what have you, a lot of that can be done by using labor-intensive and labor-based methodologies, methods of production. And engineers got together and they figured out ways of doing it. So the cost would be the same, the quality of the asset would be the same, the road would be equally good, but you're using a lot more labor, you're not spending hard-earned currency to import, and you are creating all kinds of linkages within your own economy. So that is something worth exploring, I think, especially in view of the crisis right now, and as countries want to find ways to react to it. Then, NREGA, NREGA, that is what Indira will talk about, so I'm not going to even touch that issue, except to say that if I understand this correctly from colleagues, it is the result of long-term mobilization. It was not a government program that came out of the blue. And finally, South Africa, where since 2005 in South Africa, Sweden and Australia, many, many years ago, introduced such programs out of the recognition that you can have unemployment during prosperity. Okay, Keynes revisited. I mean, you don't have markets clearing. That was the idea. And what do you do with the unemployment, whether it is 5%, 10%, whatever percent it is? Either you say you do nothing, or you can have unemployment benefits, or you can put people on some kind of a state payroll where they are not working, or you can create jobs. These are alternatives. And that is something that actually has been introduced in many countries in many instances. Employment guarantee programs. So many questions arise. What kinds of jobs? What kinds of projects? Who is going to be eligible? How long can you work? Where do you find the money? All kinds of questions. But I'm going to leave the questions aside because I'm sure you will raise them. And I will tell you what it is that we proposed here at the Institute. And there were a number of colleagues that participated in this program, including Kijon, who became the conspirator to try to persuade the South African government that it was worth to put a lot more money in one particular area. And this particular area is early childhood development and home and community-based care. So the South African program in and of itself said, because there is so much unemployment, we will create work. Where will the work take place institutionally within the Department of Public Works? What kinds of projects are we going to undertake? Road construction, water delivery, ecological latrines, environmental water conservation. But there was a little bit of an opening, actually. They said there will be a social sector. That was a first. There was something in Argentina that happened, and people will talk about it, but it was explicitly mandated by the government to have some allocation in those two areas. But guess what? Those two areas also are areas where women spend a lot of the time. Home-based care and early childhood development. So when we looked at the program very carefully, what we discovered was that it was not really a program. It was put there, but the money that they allocated was pittance, and what they were doing was, literally, you would give the fare that one needs to use in order to go from location A to location B to either get the training from an NGO under unpaid conditions or to go to a household and deliver the medication. That is not what we had in mind. So what did we do? We were lucky, and we met Erwin Friedman because we were looking for data like crazy. We knew what we wanted to propose, but we didn't have the data. So Erwin Friedman actually worked with us and shared with us data where he had costed the amount that is needed to use materials, training, food, anything and everything you can imagine that goes into delivering early childhood development for children that are 5 months old up until they are 5 years old. Then the educational system takes over of South Africa. And also for home-based care, the first one was for 50% of the population. Why? Because 50% of the population is below the poverty line. So we said, okay, what will it take to have children that are being born now being taken care of so that the health problems and nutrition and psychological problems that develop will be taken care of now? And they costed, you know, we told them the categories that we needed and they costed all that. And the other thing that they costed was home-based care for 20% of the vulnerable population that suffers from HIV/AIDS specifically. The training, pretty much everything that goes into delivering the service. And once we did that, and we had the information, we said, now we are combining unpaid work, and we know who is doing the unpaid work. So we know who will benefit from these programs in terms of reduction of unpaid work. We know who is unemployed, because I showed you the graph earlier that says, if I look at the country and I have a map, I can isolate and identify which pockets of population that are located exactly where mostly needs these jobs. So you have unpaid work, you have unemployment. Okay, now you need a model. And you need the model to do what? You need the model to show what are both the macroeconomic implications, i.e. job creation, GDP growth, expansion of taxes, and all of that. But you also need the micro-level data by type of household, 20 different types of households that we had to reorganize the information from household survey data that exists, of course, in South Africa, so that we can see what will be the impact on poverty, income poverty, I have to say. So in order to do that, we used a social accounting matrix that Kijon has spoken about and also Maureen talked about the other day, if you remember. So here you have a social accounting matrix, and here you have the unpaid work. We were not able to integrate it, but we had a satellite account. Many reasons why we did not do that, we can go into it later. But the point is that by the same household types, we knew their function in the economy with backward and forward linkages, what type of work they're doing, etc. And the same households, what is it that they're doing in terms of unpaid work? So once we have set up this model, and I'm not claiming that it is an easy task, but again, we were lucky. We were able to work with the PROVIDE team, which is the team that develops the input-output tables for the Department of Agriculture in South Africa. We put all this together. We estimate how much investment the government should come up with in order to meet these goals, and then we look at what the implications for the economy will be. And here are our results. With a 9 billion rand increase in terms of direct public job creation, the government becomes the employer of these people. You generate directly 1.2 million jobs. For every 3 jobs that the government creates, because of the multiplier effect in the economy, there is another job that gets created formally in the formal economy, in the formal economy sector. GDP increases by 1.7%. The tax expansion is such that 1/3 of the program is recovered, actually, the cost is recovered. So it doesn't cost you 9, it costs you 6, because you get the 3 back within the year, by the way. Poverty reduction, the impact on all of these households is as follows. All households that are below the ultra-poor line move above it, that participate in the program, and their poverty is reduced from whatever it was to by 80%. And all those that were below the poverty line jump the poverty line. So in terms of pro-poor growth and impacts on poverty, the program can work very well, but only for the participants, not for the entire population, clearly. Because if I have 5 million people that are unemployed and I can employ 1 million people, I do not expect poverty to be, you know, a yesteryear situation in South Africa. So I just want to conclude, actually, with the costs and benefits. And I want to say the following. When you think of benefits, one of the things that all of these studies have not included ever is the benefits that accrue from the new infrastructure and the benefits that accrue when you have a healthier population. When you deliver the service, that is not calculated. I mean, there are many studies the World Bank has come out with. I hear that Ravalion, as of late, has changed his tune, but many times he has criticized in very many articles that he has said, you know, employment guarantee schemes don't work and do not work. Why? Because never did he include the benefit incidence of these programs in terms of social service delivery, etc. And the last question that I want to pose is, what should be the monetary cost of this? I mean, when we say we will allocate resources, like exactly how much should we spend? 1% of GDP? 2% of GDP? 3% of GDP? What is the rule that will allow a government to say, okay, this is worth it. We are going to devote this many resources. And we go back to, I think, James Hines. I don't know if you remember his presentation. But the point was that you can have different kinds of targets. That's what he was saying. You can have an inflation target. You can have a growth target. Or you can have a target that puts employment right at the center of it. And then what you're asking is, what does it take in order to achieve that outcome? And if it takes 3% of GDP, let it take 3% of GDP. And if you go into deficit financing, go into deficit financing. And what about the countries that do not have the policy space and the fiscal space? Well, that is what we will talk about in the evening session today. So I will stop here. It was a very lengthy presentation. Thank you for your attention. If there are any clarifications, small kinds of questions, maybe for 4 or 5 minutes, we can do that while you're switching over. And then at the end, because the presentations are so similar, and many things that, in terms of the substance of it, I mean similar, many things that I have not talked about, Indira will talk about, and then our next two presenters. So, yes, please, Sylvia. Sylvia.
Thank you very much, Rania, for your presentation. It's really stimulating and it's really making me think a lot. And I was saying to myself, oh, Rania should come and do the same kind of study in our country. You know, we were thinking of the time used in HIV/AIDS. For me, I think that HIV/AIDS time use would is sort of a micro study, which, you know, allows us to build our own capacities back home for us now to be able to engage in this kind of thing. But having said that, your areas of job creation you've given are early childhood development and community-based home care. What exactly was involved that enabled government to create all these jobs?
My question is just the clarification. What is the period of this program? And if it is 1 year program, how would you ensure the sustainability? Like,
thank you, ma'am. Ma'am, you were mentioning about the declining employment output ratio all over the world. My first question is whether it is because of technological improvement or it is because of more labor exploitation, in the sense of maybe laborers are working more hours a day nowadays. Secondly, related to it, if there is a trade-off between productivity growth and employment, then to prioritize larger level of employment, would you argue that we have to have some control over the productivity growth?
Okay, these are substantive questions. These are not clarification, but I'll go very quickly. On the last one, I would say I would want society to give an arm and a leg in terms of growth in order to achieve more equality and human development. So this is not a scientific answer, but if you are asking, this is my response. In terms of your first question, these are total hours worked. It is not number of persons, so that takes care of that. In terms of your question, the sustainability, it will be addressed, and we will go back to it again and again. One thing that I want to say, I guess at this point of this crisis, my one solid answer is, how many $1 trillion have we come up with in order to save the financial system worldwide and in the United States? Somehow, the easing of monetary policy was no problem in order to avoid the worst. What is the worst that we can avoid? I mean, if you think about human beings, as Mariama was saying, the number of people that are malnourished today and how it is increasing, where are our priorities? So in a sense, I'm not asking the question, is it sustainable, but rather I want to turn it upside down and say, what do we mean by is it sustainable? Exactly what is the sacrifice involved in order to have such a program permanent? What is a permanent old age pensions? Do we say we will afford it maybe in the United States or in other developed countries? Maybe we will afford it if we have the cash? No. We adjust all kinds of taxes in order to be able to come up and pay. Does the government say, I'm not going to pay myself in the United States? I mean, they did it in the Soviet Union. They did it in Russia. But will they say, okay, let the whole system break down? No police. No army. No. Why? Because it's a priority. So once you set your social priorities and you put them in place, then somehow, miraculously, some things will adjust and it will be accomplished. I don't know if this is too much of a political answer, not an economic one, but that's what I... Really, that's the only answer I can come up now. Later on, we can discuss the sustainability because there are different modes of financing. For example, for South Africa, there is a study that came out from the Perry Institute, and we borrowed a lot. We learned a lot from them. Then we did our own calculations. It is sustainable. South Africa, as I have said many times, at the time that they were introducing this program, they had external reserves, the third column that I was showing, that could sustain their payments for over 10 months, and you have 25% unemployment in your country, conservatively speaking, right? No, that is not the way to do things. And then you asked, I'm not sure I understood your question, Sylvia. The number of jobs that were created? Okay. What did the programs do? Well, in terms of actual jobs and what were they delivering? Okay, so these are early childhood centers that were there or were set up or were expanded, where there was the children were dropped off, essentially, in the centers. And there was nutrition, fun and games, doctors, gardeners that had vegetable gardens that were community-owned, that were cultivated. Half of it went for sustaining the community health early childhood center. The other half of the produce would go to the people. They would take it back home. So that is on the early childhood programs. And the home-based care, it entailed the training of nurses and the training of people that can deliver home-based care. And one of the things that we proposed was actually that as part of the definition, because there are many, many different types of jobs and inputs that are needed, that part of it would be literally and directly alleviation of unpaid work. So you go to the person's home, and in addition to counseling and, you know, delivering the medication, you ask the primary carer, what do you need for the next 2-3 hours I'm available? Do you need me to go fetch the water? Do you need me to help you clean the clothes? Whatever is needed in the household. So it gives respite, sort of, you know, a little bit of breathing time to women that are doing the work. We have a 100-page document. Anybody who's interested, we will be happy to make it available. But also, for anyone who wants to get engaged in this work and wants to know the details, I will put you personally in touch with Erwin Friedman, because I'm not a doctor and I don't have the capacity that they had, and you can find out a lot more about the costing details. They developed a very nice program where you can change some assumptions on a spreadsheet and you can get the new numbers and all of that. Not a very complicated tool to use, actually.
Thanks, Rania. Well, very, very interesting your presentation. As Silvia told, I thought I think I will do our I will find I found a lot of inspirations when I come to Peru. Well, I wanted to tell you that to add to your presentation that moving is a problematic that affects 2 million of people around the world. I wonder how moving is affecting the quality of life in women. I would like to know, maybe you know, how moving is affecting men and women. Has moving increased during the crisis? I think it is a problem at moving. Migration. No, when people want to leave, that's a one key to job. Yeah, there is a phenomenon that affects that people leave into the job. No. Moving. Yeah. It's a phenomenon. Yeah. Yeah. It's something that affects too much in all the ways a person, and I think that will be interesting to find the relation, no? And how this will affect more maybe women than men.
I have to educate myself a little bit more on this, and this is what we mean by knowledge sharing and mutual capacity building. I will find out a lot more about it. Maybe we can talk a little bit more later. I have exhausted my time of presentation, my time for questions and answers. So thank you very much once again, and Indira will take over.